This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, September 21st, 2021, and school is back in session. So we're going to talk with some of our favorite experts about second-use fruit and farmhouse ales and some of the evolving trends in craft beer. So let's go around the room and introduce each other. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here. Jake?
Jake Andreas Cohn at Crooked Run Fermentation.
In Virginia, right?
Yes.
Okay, Mandy?
Hi, I'm Mandy. I'm an advanced Cicerone and food and beverage journalist based here in New York City.
And we know you as?
Oh, Beers with Mandy, of course.
Beers with Mandy. You're famous.
Yeah, all right. Definitely like to share all my journals and stories and other beer thoughts there. So.
All right. And Ian?
Hi, I'm Ian. I'm the head brewer at Transmitter Brewing. I've been here for just over, about 5.5 years.
Wow, that's great. So there's so much to talk to each about, but I want to dive into Mandy first. So Mandy, you wrote an article in VinePair about second-use fruit, and you part of that you interviewed Jake. So let's just talk about that article. What is second-use fruit? And, you know, let's clue our listeners in because everyone's talking about fruit beers. But when I think of second-use fruit, I think about things like wine pumice being turned into grappa.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing that Jake does is use wine pumice in one of his Saison farmhouse ales, which is a really great example of using this technique. But the story is covering homebrewing and how to use second-use fruit. And it's really a great thing to do to get kind of a more subtle, you know, fruit beers these days are so like punchy, juicy, in your face with that fruit character. And when you use the fruit once and then use it a second time in a more subtle beer, maybe a Crisette is really popular or a Saison, you get more subtleties from that fruit. So kind of the edges of that fruit's flavor, and instead of being so in your face, it just gives you a really nice, more complex beer, a different character, and a great way to use fruit more than once, which we're always looking for sustainability-wise.
Yeah. And then, and Jake, for a little intro, tell us, I mean, you were first Crooked Run Brewing, but now you're Crooked Run Fermentation. How has your operation evolved?
Yeah, so that's really kind of dovetails with second use fruit too. Basically, we were doing a lot of heavily fruited mixed room beers, and we were doing some fermentation with just the fruit, and then blending the resulting fruit wine. And we were kind of doing so much of that, it made sense to pursue a winery license. So when we added the winery license, we knew we didn't really want to do a sub-brand for it. Doing sub-brands is difficult. You got to build something that people are very unfamiliar with. And I've seen other breweries that get into wine try to do it, and it's definitely an uphill battle. So we just decided to change the name and change it to Crooked Run Fermentation. Did a new little logo and just put everything under that umbrella.
That's great. Well, we had you on an episode went pretty deep talking about barrel-aged beers earlier this year. When did you start using second-use fruit? And then we can just talk about like that as a trend. But in particular, I know you're working with farms and which fruits are really best for it.
Sure, yeah. So what got us into doing it was we did a collaboration with Craft Cider out of New York. It was a mixer in Berliner Weiss with Tannat grapes. And we bought them from a local winery, and they're pretty expensive. I mean, all grapes are expensive. But we realized after we made it that we really didn't need the fermentables coming from the grapes. And, you know, breweries can produce fermented, you know, beverage much more inexpensively than wineries can. So that got us thinking that maybe we should just use the pomace, the grapes that are, you know, the grape skins that are left after crushing. So we tried that on a beer called Newfangled, which I'd sent to Mandy, and it turned out really nice. And at that point, we started to do a lot more of those beers and then to try using some other types of second use fruit as well.
Great. And Mandy, how did you get turned on to this as a home brewer and as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, I write the homebrewing column every month, so I'm constantly on the lookout for things that I can, new techniques I can teach people. And I tasted Jake's beer, which was awesome, and also happened to talk to Jackie O's that same month, I believe. And they were talking about how they've used second use fruit for 5 or 10 years. So they've been doing it for a really long time, trying to get the most out of their fruit. And then went to the tap room over at Threes and they were using it too. And I thought, I think three makes a trend. I think that's the rule. So decided to write up the story. And yeah, it's a great way, you know, like exactly what Jake said, fruit is expensive. So it's like, how can you, if you're going to go for it and get that organic fruit, how can you get the most out of it?
So which fruits are best? And at what stage do you use the, I mean, let's say it's pomace, right? It's pomace or must or something.
Yeah, or like apricots. I would say stone fruits work well. You want something that's not going to be really water-based, because obviously something like a watermelon is just going to disintegrate in your first use of it. It's going to become nothing. So something that has some substance, some skin to it, maybe some pits. I think peach, apricot were a couple of the ones that we talked about. Obviously grapes. Certain berries, like a blueberry, is not really going to give you the second use flavor that you're looking for, but some raspberries and things like that that have a little more of a seed and skin to them. Basically, I mean, it is a pretty new trend as far as really calling it out and saying we're using this fruit twice. So I think experimentation is where it's at right now and figuring out what really works the best.
Yeah. Jake, tell me more about this, because I'm still kind of like, okay, I get it. I get making wine pomace into grappa, but how does it quite work in beer?
Well, what we really become fond of doing is fermenting the fruit first through a method used called carbonic maceration, which is being used more and more in winemaking and now brewing as well. Basically, you take the fruit and you put it in a vessel that's sealed off from oxygen, and you purge it with CO2. And then you allow it to just ferment naturally with what's on the skin. You don't need to add any liquid to it. The yeast will actually start to break the fruit down from the inside out. It tends to produce a really, really fruity fruit wine, if that makes sense. When you have 100% carbonic wines, they can be very, very juicy. But we do that, we take the liquid out, and then we press what's left over. And so what Mandy said about guidelines for using second use fruit is definitely 100% right. Anything that kind of holds up well. But we actually did use blueberries recently, and this kind of is not necessarily something you could do at the homebrew scales easily, but we have a wine press that we use, and you know, you load grapes or whatever into it, and the splatter inflates and pushes out all the remaining juice. So that helps us get the remainder out, and then you can take the skins or pomace and use that in a beer. But that's really what we've been doing recently, and it's good because I think it gives you the most mileage out of everything. And if you're not going to press everything, you can actually do it all in one vessel. You drain the juice after carbonic maceration and blend that with whatever you're making. And then you refill the vessel with beer or wine or whatever else you want to use for the second use fruit. So that's what we've been doing.
Let me just say, when we talk about this, I'm obviously obsessed with good grappa. So I don't even know how you actually make grappa. I know you start with this wine must. Or, you know, how do you make grappa? How do you distill with just these kind of things? Mandy, you want to take that one?
I'm not a grappa maker. I do not know.
I can take a guess.
Take a guess.
Yeah,
I want to orient myself and my listeners.
I like grappa. I don't know anything about. I couldn't tell you exactly how it's made, but you really can distill pretty much, you know, anything. I mean, ethanol and things like that are made, you know, from just the small amount of sugar that's in corn. So as long as there's still always going to be sugar left in the skins and the fruit. So if I had to guess, you're either relying on that sugar or just adding more cane sugar, you know, similar to rum making where you make a wash. but that would be my guess.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you would add more liquid or just go for it on the what's left over. But yeah, I was just going to mention on a homebrew scale, second use fruit doesn't have to be quite as complicated as they make it. I'm sure Jake gets the most out of the flavor, but you can basically, you know, put some peaches into a saison, empty off, go ahead and bottle that saison, and then put something maybe with a little more of a subtle character, like a grisette or something, or a smaller saison, a table beer over top of it. And just as long as you're basically taking the beer right off.
Well, Mandy, what if I'm at home? Let's say I have some ripe peaches and I eat the fruit and I save the pits and the skin. Could you use that in brewing?
I think you could try it. I would say you would get like a lot of tannin extraction from that. You might get some pretty strong almond flavor from the pits, maybe more than what you would get as far as peach character. But, you know, that's what home brewing is fun. Maybe you split a batch and just try half of your batch on that and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, let's get Ian in. So, Ian, we invited you to the show to talk about second use fruit. We're also going to talk about a lot of other things. So,
sure. So we've been doing using second use fruit for maybe 3 years now. And I think our process might be a little bit different than Jake's. So typically what we're doing is we're making a kettle sour that then we will primary ferment, and then we'll get fresh fruit or frozen fruit, and we'll process it in-house, and we will recirculate that in the finished sour beer, the quick sour, the kettle sour style beer. Let that ferment in secondary, and we'll crash and rack off that liquid from the fruit, go and package that, whether it's kegs or cans. And then what we'll do is we'll take a barrel beer that's been aged for anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half, and we'll rack that sour beer. Typically, it's like a golden sour or just your basic straightforward sour beer that's barrel aged, and rack that on top of that used fruit.
Wow.
And then we'll let that sit anywhere from 3 to 6 or 9 months. And then sometimes we'll blend, we'll use, you know, if we have two kettle sours back to back, one of the most recent ones we did was with peaches and blueberries. And so we reused that fruit after the secondary fermentation of the kettle sour. And then we'll blend that, let that sit, and we rack that off, and then that goes into kegs, and we'll hand bottle that.
You know, Ian, and the time that you've been at Transmitter, let's go bigger. I remember it was always Transmitter saisons and very limited, and every beer was perfect. how has the brewery evolved? And, you know, were you guys always using fruit? You know.
Yeah.
And what beers are they?
Sure. So we have two series that we use, our pH line, 1, 2, 3, 4. If you're not familiar with the naming convention, for Transmitter, it's the letter is the style of beer, and then the number is just the different recipe. So our pH series are all kettle sours. And that will use, either fresh fruit or frozen fruit that's hand processed for secondary, and those are all kettle sours. And then we have our H line, which is our harvest ales, and those are all oak aged that then get hit with some type of fruit in secondary fermentation as well. And that's all typically funky beer. It has, you know, a lot of different strains of yeast going on, and those will all get hand bottled. And if those that aren't familiar with Transmitter, everything we do is conditioned in the package. So we'll bottle condition, keg condition, and can condition the finished beer.
Yeah, in your time working there, I mean, when you go to other breweries, because I'm always fascinated with what you guys do in Transmitter. Were there some observations you have? I mean, I don't want you to diss anyone, but I remember years ago, Anthony sat with me and he said he was kind of saying that he always cared about giving his beers time. And it sounds like that's what you're still doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So part of the deal, and important, I just cracked the Harvest Ale with blueberries and peaches. Yeah, everything we package needs to be at a final terminal gravity. And the reason, because we're packaging with additional sugar and yeast. And so if you have unfermentable or fermentable sugar still left in that beer, you're going to create bottle bombs. You're going to, you know, have overcarbonated kegs, so on and so forth. So, yeah, when I go out and taste other people's fruited sours and such, and, you know, folks are adding lactose and, you know, they add the fresh fruit, you know, a day or two before they package it. It's, you know, these big juicy bombs that, you know, are so overpowering, and you really don't taste the base beer, the beer. Sometimes I don't even call that beer. Like a lot of places are just packaging fruit juice.
Wow. Hey, Jake, so how does it all fit with you guys as Crooked Run Fermentation, you know, in terms of your packaging and your production? You've got wines, you've got fruit beers, you've got, you know, barrel aged beers. How is it all working together? Because everything I've had of yours has been great.
Thanks, Jimmy. Yeah, so we just try to make something for everybody. I mean, our passion tends to be more mixed firm, natural wine, cool ship beers, and lagers. But we try to make everything, and we try to put as much thought and care into every style. So we do overfruited smoothie stuff as well, but made the decision to really mostly stick to seltzers for those beers. It's undeniable that unfermented fruit adds some really positive things. And there's been a fair amount of resistance in the industry, mostly based upon the fact that, some of the breweries doing it would have cans that exploded. But you can pasteurize them and that won't happen. They are difficult to serve in the keg though. There's some other quality concerns, but the results are pretty good. But we mostly stuck the seltzer for that because Ian is right. Like, I'm not really sure how those beers are really beer at all. They're, you know, a third to 50% fruit puree. So we kind of decided to just stick to seltzers for that, because if it's not really a beer to begin with, then if you're kind of a purist, then there's not really much to say. It's like, yeah, this is not beer. But it all fits together pretty well. And we've got this mixed room golden sours with fruit. They're finished totally dry. And then we have fruit smoothie seltzers and other stuff like that too. So just something for everybody.
Hey, Jay, can I jump in? What are you guys doing to test for terminal gravity?
On our mixed room stuff?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you guys are looking for, on the mixed room stuff, something that is, you know, is totally dry. So.
Yeah. Most of the time they're spending like at least a year in the barrel. So we figured like they're finishing between like zero and one, maybe 1.5. But usually closer down to zero.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Mandy, what do you think of this conversation so far?
I mean, those are my favorite kind of beers that finish down around zero. So that's why I'm a fan of both Transmitter and the mixed firm stuff down that Jake's making. So definitely that's my style. Like I was talking about before we started recording, those like really dry French saisons are usually what I'm home brewing at home. So not too far off.
Well, Mandy, I wanted to talk to you for a long time. I'm so proud of you that I know you've been winning a lot of awards for the American Homebrew Association. Just tell us how you got into this field, because you started as an Instagrammer or what?
No, yeah, I got into beer kind of how I got into home cooking and home bread making and baking, everything like that. I just really like to make everything from scratch. And, you know, there's more fun equipment to buy as a home brewer and ways to upgrade things and to track your recipes and stuff. So I really got into the kind of geeking side of home brewing. And in 2016, that was the first year I entered the National Homebrew Competition. And I got a gold for my Saison. And from there, I met so many people that weekend. It was my first time ever going to like a real beer event. So I started the Instagram kind of to stay in touch and meet new beer people and homebrewers and things like that. I actually started on Twitter, I should say. I didn't start the Instagram until 2018 because in 2016, I don't think anyone was on Instagram as much. So I started taking some pictures and doing that kind of thing in 2018 after I'd already gotten my certified Cicerone. So it's been three years now, I guess.
And when did you get into the Cicerone program?
Same. Actually, that was, like, I guess, a fateful weekend for me in 2016 because Cicerone had a little like table in the National Homebrew Competition Conference Center. And I got interested and they were saying, you know, if you already know your styles, you already obviously know the brewing process to be able to homebrew, you're halfway there to getting your certification. So started there, got my advanced in 2019, and then I'm going for master in November. So I'm sitting at my desk that's covered in flashcards right now, getting ready for that.
Well, I'm really proud of you. I mean, you're a real educator. Like there's two advanced Cicerones whom I know now, and you're both educating. So, you know, M. Sauter at Pints and Panels, you know, like she's always putting out like the beer recipes through her graphics and beer styles. And today I was reading your Instagram, and a lot of times with Instagram, we don't read it. We just see the pictures. And I was actually like, whoa, she's talking about decoction. And I was like, I still don't understand what decoction is.
Well, I hope you understand it a little better after reading that caption.
You know, I did. I reached out to Chris Loring from Notch Brewing, and I'm like, Chris, we got to do a October show about decoction brew. So,
yeah, definitely. I mean, my next Fine Pair column coming out probably sometime this week, maybe next, is about Oktoberfests. Because if you're in Munich and you're drinking an Oktoberfest beer, it's going to be a really light, golden lager. And here in America, we think of Oktoberfest as that like amber, kind of darker, a little bit more full mouthfeel Marzen. So two separate styles kind of existing out there under the name Oktoberfest.
Yeah. And Ian, have you made any Oktoberfest beers? I know you guys make a great like old school lager that I really like.
Yeah, we just came out with our pre-prohibition lager, which is an American style lager that has six row and like corn in it. And that we lagered that almost 10 weeks this time. And then because we're package conditioning, it gets another almost month in the keg before we'll put it up and sell it. But yeah, we do a Marzen. We try and stay away from doing a strictly Oktoberfest just because we don't want to corner ourselves into having to have that ready by, you know, September 1st. We actually have a margin that we're packaging next week. We felt like we needed some additional lager time, and that's going to go close to 12 weeks of lager time. And so, yeah, we definitely would have missed the Oktoberfest September deadline.
Well, that's thumbs up to you guys, Transmitter. You guys are not on anybody else's schedule except for when the beer is ready, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, I mean, it's funny just to see, you know, a lot of places are beholden to the 6 week lager time. And I don't know if that's who came up with that or why it is designated as a 6 week time. I think you really have to taste the product and figure out when it's ready. Like, just because your 6 weeks is up doesn't mean, all right, it's time to push it over to the bright tank. Let's carve the shit out of this and put it in a keg. Like,
yeah.
We let the beer tell us when it's ready, and we kind of go from there.
No, that's beautiful. I'm going to run over to West Side Market on 3rd Avenue in the East Village and grab some of your pre-prohibition lager, because I know that right now Martin there has a great selection of beer always. Hey, Jake, before we were talking about seasonality, and you said you're making second use fruit in the summer because you have the fruit. How available are farms to you? And you want to give a shout out to some of the farms you work with? And then I'm going to ask you to tell me about, you know, how long you're going to, you know, hold these beers that you're making in the summer.
Yeah, we get a lot of our fruit. Well, we get all of our fruit at this point from Virginia, all of our whole fruit. But most of it comes from agroberry farms outside Richmond. Then locally, Great Country Farms. And this is all for fruit other than grapes. We get our grapes from a couple local wineries, Walsh Family Wine, Fabioli Cellars. We don't grow anything ourselves. We're in flex warehouse space, so it's not really an option for us. But those are all the ones we're currently using right now. And then in terms of how much time these beers get, they usually get about a year. If they have PDO in them, they get a lot more time. We have a couple beers that we just use a blend of Lacto Brevis and Brett B, and that's worked pretty well. And this can be done actually pretty quickly. But they're almost more akin to like maybe old school Berliner Weiss, where like you kind of had a very mixed fermentation going on. Everything else, 1 to 2 years, our oldest. We have our first goose coming out tentatively in spring. But that, of course, is going to have beer that's at this point 3.5 years old.
Wow! And do you separate your sour and fruity beers from your non sour beers and your wines? I mean, it's not a brewery, winery. What do you call your facilities?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, it definitely doesn't fit the bill of typical winery, and I wouldn't really call it like maybe. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that, but I will say we put all of our low intervention wine and mixed fermentation beer on one side, which is a separate space that we got over the course of the pandemic. Everything was already separated before that, but it helped to have almost a completely new bay just for that stuff. So it's all segregated. And if you're working on that side, typically you don't work on the other side in the same day.
And do you have to change your shoes or something? Or
we just spray them down with alcohol.
You like that, right? I'm thinking about one time I went to the Zabret's hot dog factory in the Bronx, and we had to go in and put hairnets on and these like blue suits on over everything. And they have. I understand it's you're actually in food production, right? I mean, once you're getting into fruits and wines and sours. You have to really follow a lot of different standards, don't you?
Yeah, it's not as heavily regulated because beer, even if it might not taste great, can't really become unsafe to consume as long as no chemicals or anything go into it. But yeah, I mean, people wear gloves and really you're supposed to wear a hair and beard net, I believe, in Virginia. That's not really commonly observed, but at least a hat.
Yeah. Hey, Mandy, I know you wanted to ask Ian some questions about other styles of beer.
Oh, yeah. No, I just think it's awesome, like a fully farmhouse-based brewery, although obviously some lagers in there. I have a series about farmhouse brewing. That's how I came across Jake. And so, yeah, I just would love one day to do try this farmhouse with a transmitter and talk about what makes them stand apart. Do you guys work with farmers or anything like that in the New York state, Ian?
So we do, we have a series of beers, which is NY, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think there's six of them, in which we use all New York state malt and hops. Whether that malt is actually grown in New York, we don't know. But we use the New York maltsters for that. However, most of those beers aren't what I would consider a farmhouse style. We do have NY1, which is a rye saison, which I guess you could lump into the farmhouse category. We kind of differentiate Saison from farmhouse, mm-hmm. Which I think is fairly different from most breweries. So our F line, our F label, all use at least one strain of Brett. And those are all stainless fermented beers. And so our Saisons, which is the S1234, et cetera, is all Saison yeast, but it's pretty typically it's going to be Brett, Saccharomyces. And so those are all clean beers, also fermented and stainless.
Are they all the same Saison strain? Do you guys know what you use or use them?
No. So S1, S2, S3, S4, what is S5? I don't even know what S5 is off the top of my head. S6. So I would say there's for all the Saisons we do, there's probably 8 different strains.
Oh, wow.
That we're using. And then our F series, some of them is mixed firm, so we'll use primary Saccharomyces, and then in secondary we'll get hit with Brett. And so we have 4 to 5 different strains of Brett.
Yeah, I think F4 is my go-to when people ask for a local farmhouse ale or Saison recommendation.
Yeah, that's our triple Brett. It's 3 different strains. And off the top of my head, I can't remember which ones they are.
I will say that's the most I've ever heard your numbers and letters explained, Ian. So my head's kind of spinning, but I love
people,
your beer.
People either love it or they hate it. They're like, I can never remember which number. But then at the same time, they're like, oh, I always know my favorites. Or like, it's so easy to, you know, to come in and remember, you know, the one I liked. So
yeah, hey, we're off to a great start. And what's cool is the next step is that Cider Week is next week. So we'll be kicking off Cider Week October 2nd at Cider Feast in Brooklyn. Can check it out at jimmysnumber43.com. And there's a lot going on around the whole New York State for Cider Week. It's been changed into a statewide event, and the real focus is getting people to go to cideries, kind of like wine trails are upstate. So check it out at Cider Week New York. All right, we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Become a member and support us at heritageradionetwork.org. So we're talking about second-use fruit and kind of the evolving craft beer scene with Jake from Crooked Run Fermentation, Mandy Naglish from Beers with Mandy, and Ian Combs of Transmitter Brewing. Well, this is quite an interesting but also kind of obscure topic when it got pitched to me, the idea of using second use fruit, and I'm still stuck on, okay, you've got wine must and you make grappa. you know, I'm not really thinking as a brewer because I'm not a brewer, but I do think as like a pub owner and as a consumer, it's like, what is second use fruit going to do for my palate? That yeast or hops aren't. Jake, you want to talk about one?
Sure. Well, so
because I don't really want a fruity beer, but I do appreciate things like Goose's and, you know, Creeks and other like lambics that have fruit in them.
Yeah. So when you second use fruit, this is kind of hard to explain, but if you're removing, the liquid in it, if you were to use, this is just, I'm kind of making up numbers here, but just for the sake of explanation, if you had like 60 pounds of unfermented fruit, that, you know, after the water is removed, would weigh considerably less. So if you use the equivalent amount of second use fruit, especially if like you've allowed the liquid to come out of it, like theoretically you might be able to have like 60 pounds of pomace equal like 600 pounds of grapes in terms of you know, some of the flavors you're going to get out of it. And obviously that depends on a lot on how much is left in the skin, but you can get a surprising amount out of second use. It can be subtle, but it can definitely be not subtle, particularly with grapes. We actually did one with blueberries, and blueberries, a lot of flavors in the skins. We did a Paquette, which is like a low ABV wine made with second use fruit, and we used blueberries. And it's actually more blueberry forward than a lot of beers we've made with even more blueberries. So the skins still pack quite a bit, but they can be pretty subtle too. You really just kind of have to mess around and figure it out. But the more flavor and tannins in the skins, the more flavor you're going to get out of it.
So in terms of styles, I don't know if Mandy wants to take this. How do consumers like perceive these beers or these mixed ferments? Like Paquette as a wine, I know my wife tried some, and it wasn't what she was thinking when she got wine. Is there a style that you can say this is, or a way to communicate to like a customer at your tap room? Jake, let's go, Jake. It's Jake.
Well, style wise, they're kind of all over the place, but they are kind of going to be usually some type of grisette or saison or golden sour. In the description, I would just always tell people like whether it's going to be subtle fruit flavor or more than that, but I can't really say it wouldn't be anything specific. The only thing I can say is like, so far for wine, it's always been these Paquettes, which are these little 4% wines made with second use fruit. And that's even kind of hard to describe. Like I would say it's kind of like wine seltzer, but it's more full flavored than that. So it's just kind of its own thing. That wasn't a very good answer, but I really don't know how to describe it. It's just like, it all depends on how the beer turns out.
Yeah. And you have to be open to trying things, don't you?
Yeah, for sure. Which anybody into mixed fermentation beer is pretty open anyways. So they're cool with it.
Yeah. And hey, Ian, I saw you posted about making some canned Belgian style candied sugar. Talking about styles, when I think of styles, I always think about drinking really good Belgian triples and how smooth they are and how deceptively strong. What are you doing with the Belgian sugar?
Yeah, so we just take your regular old Domino sugar, the table sugar, and we'll, depending on the style of beer, we'll cook it down. So for our triples, it doesn't cook very long because we don't want to add any color to the finished beer. And so most of our triples will just dilute the table sugar, cook it for, 20 or 30 minutes just to kill anything that's living in it. And then we'll recirculate that in our triples in the tank. And then that goes and re-ferments rather quickly. I think what you were talking about, the post I made, we have the Belgian double that we make, and that candy sugar will cook for anywhere from 2 to 4 days And so it ends up the final sugar product is almost like molasses. And so that'll get added to the whirlpool kettle and then sent to the fermenter. And it's amazing how much depth of flavor you can get from that candy sugar. We've always made it in-house. It's way cheaper than buying it. The super dark Belgian candy sugar you can find online is ridiculously expensive for, you know, what it is. It's just sugar. And so we've always made it in-house. And we kind of have, you know, obviously more control over the flavor profile then as well.
Mandy, I was just talking about styles and your homebrew articles and recipes and things. Are there certain styles of beer that are more popular, you know, in your writing or in your homebrew crowd?
I mean, IPA is going to be pretty much, you can call anything an IPA now. You know, you have your sour IPAs, your fruited IPAs, your imperial IPAs, your milkshake IPAs. They're finding a lot of ways to work IPA in there. I would say the only IPA that didn't survive is probably the Brut IPA. But it's funny, Ian was mentioning earlier how they label their farmhouse versus saison as far as farmhouse ales. And I have this very nascent TikTok, but one of the questions I was getting was like, what can I expect? Like a sour beer versus a farmhouse ale versus saison. And I think those lines are getting a little bit more blurred. People put mixed fermentation on some things. People put saison on other things that aren't clean. And then other people, like Ian, use saison to kind of signal that it is something clean. Sometimes they'll say mixed fermentation saison. So I think people are curious about those things, but it's like a little precarious if you're just kind of becoming adventurous and getting interested in things. You might order something that you think will taste like Saison DuPont and it will taste more like a fruit lambic or something. So, what we're talking about, second use fruit, that kind of thing.
I mean, do you think it's a problem that there is such a wide range of flavors and everything?
I mean, I don't think it's a problem about the flavors. I do think it's maybe a problem for consumers, and it's something that I personally am trying to like help communicate more and get people a little bit more interested in trying new things. I would love for people to really understand what Brett is. I think Brett can make just some really great dry, fruity beers that aren't, you know, tasting of horse blanket and tasting of barnyard that people always expect. And I think people see kind of those code words, you know, Brett or mixed fermentation, and they just get a little bit afraid where they might be a little more open to something like Saison or sour IPA.
Mandy, here's a beer question. Okay. Mm-hmm. I know you're practicing for your master cicerone. What's a classic Belgian beer that is made with Brett that's also an IPA?
That's also an IPA. I mean, I don't know. I would say people call Orval like a Brett beer that's a Belgian pale ale. That's as close as I can think of off the top of my head.
Oh, that I was wrong. I was thinking Orval. So
I thought that's what you were thinking.
See,
do I pass? Am I a master cicerone now?
Oh, you pass. I'm probably still at the cicerone server level like I was 12 years ago. But we'll have some fun with you. How about this, Ian? Mandy's going up for the master cicerone. What's a question you'd want to ask her to test her knowledge? Because you know the answer. So
I don't know anything about the BJCP guidelines or like style wise. A lot of the reasons why we don't submit a lot of beer to competitions is because our beer doesn't fit into those styles and like those categories. And I think there are a lot of breweries like that that don't really care about the style guidelines. I guess it's hard to navigate, when you do decide to submit for, you know, the Great American Beer Festival or competition or some of the New York State competitions. we'll sit down and decide or kind of talk through where do we think, you know, a certain beer should go for its best placement. And so I think there are a lot of, you know, the 8,000 plus breweries. I think there are a handful that aren't really concerned with the style guidelines.
So you just don't submit it all to GABF?
We didn't this year. We have in the past. And, you know, it's funny because we'll get feedback from the judges and, you know, well, a lot of times the beer is too carbonated for the Belgian Saison category.
Like, I feel you.
Like, we're bottle finishing and, you know, we're shooting for like 3.2, 3.3 volumes, and that's how we like to drink it. So, you know, it can be frustrating sometimes.
Can I ask Ian a question?
Go for it, Jake.
On that note, that was something I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned natural carbonation and can conditioning a fair amount. Why do you guys do that so much?
We've always have. We didn't can when we first opened. We just did 750 bombers, cork and cage. And it was just that was the way that the two owners, Rob and Anthony, homebrewed. They package conditioned everything. It's kind of fits with the style of beers we make. However, we are making a lot more lagers, and package conditioning lagers can be a little tricky. But yeah, I don't even know how to use a carb stone or how to force carbonate beer.
We like natural carbonation too. We do both, but on anything bottled that isn't a stout, it's getting naturally carbonated. I think it produces some good flavors on mixed room stuff for sure. But yeah,
cool. the mouthfeel, you know, you get a tighter, smaller bubble, I think. And you're able to carbonate way higher than you know, a canning line can actually can a product.
What's the limit? How high do you guys go on cans?
I mean, we typically, it's style dependent, but you know, the Saisons will, you know, 2.9, 3.2 ish.
Oh, cool.
Our gold nails are above 3. And that leaves a little bit of wiggle room for additional attenuation if the beer sits around a little bit longer than we expected, or you know, it's funny a lot of times we'll say, you know, the last beer that leaves the brewery is probably the best tasting one.
Oh yeah.
Because it has just all that time, that extra time to really condition and, you know, drop right. And, you know, the one thing with package conditioning is we really struggle to make cloudy or hazy beer. It's almost impossible. Like, every beer that we make is drops bright.
I mean, to me, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't really see why beer has to be cloudy. I mean, I don't even know why that became a trend, but
I don't think it tastes good.
I agree.
I can do a number on your stomach if you're drinking a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Ian, because I do think good beer takes time, and beer is important to me. This is why I think where I'm going with this show is that I don't necessarily, I'm not hardcore about styles, but I want a well-made beer, and I also care. Like, when I was years ago, when I used to drink a lot of triples, Belgian triples, I started learning that. Certain beers gave me a really bad headache. I mean, I'm talking about drinking multiple triples when you're working in a pub, but that was my thing. And then there were certain beers, I'm not going to name them, that whether it was what sugar they used or how they used it, or perhaps they were just using malts instead of sugar, I didn't get a headache. So I'm like, I feel like I'm a heavy drinker consumer. And I'm like, I care about how I feel the next day. And I still don't know. It's like I judge a beer by, wow, I had that beer. I had two beers. They were IPAs. I felt like shit the next day. And other beers, I had two beers and I felt great. In fact, I'm going to give a plug to – I've been up in Boston. My friends at Lamplighter in Cambridge, they made a wet hop. It's called a harvest ale, but it's like a 6% pale ale. Wet hop Cambridge summer, end of summer beer. And I was at the pub yesterday. I had two of those, and I felt great this morning. You know, maybe a little groggy, but I didn't have any like headache or bad feeling. And you think, Ian, that part of that is the ingredients you use, but also the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, under attenuated beer that is sweet and hazy and juicy, like a lot of the IPAs, will make you feel pretty terrible the next day.
Yeah. So it is a holistic thing. Cause I think that beer and alcohols can be part of a healthy lifestyle, but it's also like, you can't drink bad crap either. You know, you should, I always feel like you should be able to have a beer and pick yourself up after a long day, or you went for a run or something. There's definitely good things in it, electrolytes and other things. And I guess you can't say there's health benefits, but I feel like well-made alcoholic products from, you know, good ingredients can be a plus to your life. You know, Jake, what about you with the use of fruits and everything? You probably get into a lot of confusion amongst your consumers. Are most of these things sold in your tap rooms, or are you also packaging a lot of different styles of products?
Yeah, we bottle and can everything that we make, as well as offer draft. Well, and then we don't really do a lot of distribution, so it is mostly going out the door at our own place, which is good because consumers, you know, can have everything explained to them, and we've got a good taproom staff, so there isn't too much confusion.
Yeah. Ian, do you have a question for Jake as a brewer? You can go back to second use fruit or mixed fermentation.
Yeah, I guess for the second use fruit. So you guys are you're squeezing or you're processing and you're taking essentially the juices from those fruit and then blending with, you know, whatever base beer, package that, and then you're racking. Is it always sour beer on top of it, or what? The second use fruit or the second use beers,
Yeah, it's always mixed from stuff because we don't know what was on the skins, and it most certainly includes some type of wild yeast, if not other stuff. But I wish, man, I mean, like I've thought about using pomace in a clean beer, especially if like we made a tea with it first with some very hot water and then pumped that in. I think that'd be pretty cool, but I haven't gotten around to it yet.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. Hey, Mandy, what's something that we didn't cover in the show today related to your article? I know you talked to Matt Levy from Threes. He wasn't able to come on, but he was very enthusiastic about this subject.
Yeah, they have a whole series at Threes where they're just trying different fruits second use. So I'm sure. And I also talked to, I think, the guys at Wild East here in New York, who also are doing a lot of second use fruit, mostly with grisette, which they also use mixed fermentation. But I guess the whole point of the article and what I would say for anyone listening is just that it's a really fun thing to do homebrew wise. You know, like you were saying, it's kind of hard to grasp when we're just talking about it. And I don't think it's necessarily something that brewers would use as a marketing tactic or even necessarily try to explain to consumers, but it is a different kind of flavor you can get from the fruit. If you were going to try it at home, I would suggest, I thought peaches were really successful. I haven't tried apricots, but I've heard good things about that as well. I don't know how many of us are going to be able to get our hands on wine grapes or spent wine grapes. So,
you might be able to get them really. If you're in New York, it's going to be more difficult, but like if you're in a state that has, you know, any vineyards, just shoot them an email because they're composting most of it. The first time we did it before we actually started making wine, we just went to our local winery we're friends with, and I just pulled up in a truck with a bunch of bins and just, you know, we filled them up off of their press, and they were going out in the field otherwise. So like they got tons of it.
So maybe I need to make a road trip up to the Finger Lakes and just fill a carboy in my trunk.
You can freeze it too. We did a collab with Unseen Creatures down in Miami, and I just mailed them a bunch of frozen pomace for it.
Oh, wow. So did you just like dry ice it in the mail, or
I vacuum sealed it and I froze it and I just shipped it as quickly as I could.
Wow.
There
you go.
Hey, I'd like just like to add one more thing. So, you know, we're talking about second use fruit, obviously. You know, a lot of times you're not going to get a ton of flavor out of it, but you still can get a ton of color. And so if you have a beer that you just want, you know, like that's the reason we use blueberries a lot, because there's so much color still left in that second use blueberry, where you might not get a ton of flavor, so to speak, but you can turn, you know, your golden ale into, you know, a nice, you know, pink or purple hue. So that's another reason to you can use it.
Yeah. Now you're reminded, I can't believe we haven't mentioned cherries yet, but that's another great second use. Their pits have a lot of flavor and they would have a lot of good color as well. So.
Wow. I really appreciate this, guys. This great introduction to second use fruit, and we covered a lot of things: natural carbonation and fermenting. And just want to say thank you, guys, so much for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. Let's go around the room one more time, and everyone just say their name and where they're working, and we'll sign off. Jake.
Jake Endres, co-owner at Crooked Run Fermentation in Virginia. And before I go, Ian, I'm up in Brooklyn fairly often. I'll definitely come visit you guys next time I'm up.
Oh, please do.
Great. Ian?
Ian Kalmus, head brewer at Transmitter Brewing. We're located in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Come see us.
All right. And Mandy?
I'm Mandy from Beers with Mandy. And yeah, you guys can follow me and you'll see definitely some Crooked Run as well as some Transmitter on Instagram.
And Jake, what's a Crooked Run that we're drinking or talking about today besides the Newfoundland?
Newfangled, yeah. I think the other one, the other second use free one that I sent was called Gob. Is grisette with second use blackberries.
Great. And Mandy, when are you taking the Master Cicerone test?
November 3rd and 4th.
All right, you're going to let us know when you find out. It takes a while for the results, doesn't it?
Yeah, they usually like to call right before Christmas, which is a really nice treat.
All right. And Ian, it's great to talk to you again, my friend. I think last time I saw you was like a week before the pandemic. We were at KCBC during Beer Week.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah. So thanks so much, guys. A big thanks to Armin, our engineer, for working with us and making this sound good. And it'll be, when you hear this, it'll be a few days later. It'll be a live podcast on Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jimmy. Woo,
all right.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.